Welcome. Good evening. Apologies for the late start. One of our performers ran into traffic problems on the M4, I believe. Surely not. But we're all here now and ready to start. I would like to take this time on behalf of the Ledbury Poetry Festival to thank our sponsors for this event. We're extremely fortunate to have five such eminent performers here tonight. And we are very grateful to the Arts Council England, to Guardian Live, and to local sponsors Alison and Nigel Falls. So thank you very much. Right, at this point, it is time to turn it over to the professionals. So Ursula and Mark, please.
And here they come. Tramp. Well done, darling. Well done. Well done.
Okay. Hello, everyone, and welcome. My name is Ursula Owen. Women have always written poetry, and they've always been subversive. They've had to be. Women poets have battled over the centuries to express a view of themselves and of the world, which is as comprehensive as those of men. Though women have always written poems that are loving, tender, and reflective, Dangerous Women is an anthology that also focuses on poems with a sharper edge, assertive, ironic, challenging, angry. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, who was born in Ledbury, asked poets to weep and write. A curse from the depths of womanhood is very salt and bitter and good. Here we have poems from many countries, about love and loss, about politics and war, about families and growing old, about sex and independence. Poetry refusing stereotypes, full of surprises. We have three wonderful actors reading tonight. Juliet Stevenson in the middle. Francesca Alice on the far right. And Abigail Thor on my left. And we'll have occasional comments from Mark Fisher, whose knowledge of poetry, as I think many of you already know, is second to none, and me. Maya Angelou said, "Poetry is written for the human voice, and until you read it aloud, you will never love it." So now we'll begin to do just that, and we hope you enjoy this evening of Dangerous Women.
Amy Lowell in The Sisters spelled it out. We're a queer lot, we women who write poetry. And when you think how few of us there have been, it's queerer still. I wonder what it is that makes us do it.
As Ursula said, women have always written wonderful poetry. Going right back to Sappho in 600 BC, we only have work from her that survived in fragments via Latin translations. But this extract from De Sublimitate by Longinus gives some sense of her.
Then my tongue fails, and from my brow the liquid drops in silence flow. Then wandering fires run through my blood. Then cold binds up the languid flood. All pale and breathless then I lie. I sigh, I tremble, and I die.
Fast forward to the 16th century, and Anne Askew wrote while in Newgate Prison, waiting to be a burn to the heretic, poor woman.
It's called The Ballad Which Anne Askew Made and Sang When She Was in Newgate. Like as the armed knight appointed to the field, with this world will I fight, and faith shall be my shield. Faith is that weapon strong which will not fail at need. My foes, therefore, among their will I proceed. As it is had in strength and force of Christ's way, it will prevail at length, though all the devils say nay. Faith in the Father's old obtained righteousness, which makes me very bold to fear no world's distress. I now rejoice in heart, and hope bid me do so, for Christ will take my part and ease me of my woe.
And here is Anne Bradstreet, who was an extraordinary poet. She was a Puritan and emigrated to America, and she was the first woman to be published both in Massachusetts, which is where she landed in the States, and back here in England.
To my dear and loving husband, Anne Bradstreet, if ever two were one, then surely we. If ever man were loved by wife, then thee. If ever wife was happy in a man, compare with me, ye women, if you can. I prize thy love more than whole mines of gold, or all the riches that the east doth hold. My love is such that rivers cannot quench, nor aught but love from thee give recompense. Thy love is such I can no way repay. The heavens reward thee manifold, I pray. Then while we live, in love let so persever, that when we live no more, we may live ever.
And there was pain in Mary Carey's writing.
Upon the site of my abortive birth. What birth is this? A poor despised creature? A little embryo void of life and feature? 7 times I went my time, when mercy giving deliverance unto me and mine, all living, strong, right proportioned, lovely girls and boys, their fathers, mothers present, hoped for joys. That was great wisdom, goodness, power, love, praise to my dear Lord, lovely in all his ways. This is no less. The same God hath it done. Submits my heart, that's better than a son. In giving, taking, stroking, striking, still his glory and my good is his, my will. In that then this now both, good God most mild, his will's more dear to me than any child. I also joy that God hath gained one more to praise him in the heavens than was before, and that this babe, as well as all the rest, since it had a soul, shall be forever blessed.
But it was only in the late 18th century that women began to write poetry about more political, more overtly political issues.
The Rights of Woman by Anna Letitia Barbauld. Yes, injured woman, assert thy right. Woman too long degraded, scorned, oppressed, born to rule in partial laws despite, resume thy native empire o'er the breast. Go forth arrayed in panoply divine, that angel pureness which admits no stain. Go, bid proud man his boasted rule resign, and kiss the golden scepter of thy reign. Thy rights are empire. Urge no meaner claim. Felt, not defined, and if debated, lost, like sacred mysteries which, withheld from fame, shunning discussion, are revered the most. Try all that wit and art suggest to bend of thy imperial foe the stubborn knee. Make treacherous man thy subject, not thy friend. Thou mayest command, but never canst be free. But hope not, courted idol of mankind, on this proud eminence secure to stay. Subduing and subdued, thou soon shalt find thy coldness soften and thy pride give way. Then abandon each ambitious thought. Conquest or rule, thy heart shall feebly move. in nature's school, but her soft maxims taught that separate rights are lost in mutual love.
As we go into the 19th century, there certainly continued to be dissent, but also a lot of poetry by women which was rather more personal than piano.
Thoughts on my sick bed, Dorothy Wordsworth. And has the remnant of my life been pilfered of this sunny spring? And have its own prelusive sound touched in my heart no echoing string? Ah, say not so. The hidden life couchant within this feeble frame hath been enriched by kindred gifts that undesired, unsought for came. With joyful heart in youthful days, when fresh each season in its round, I welcome the earliest celandine glittering upon the mossy ground. With busy eyes I pierce the lane in quest of known and unknown things. The primrose, a lamp on its fortress rock, the silent butterfly spreading its wings, the violet, betrayed by its noiseless breath, the daffodil dancing in the breeze, the caroling thrush on his naked perch, towering above the budding trees. No prisoner in this lonely room. I saw the green banks of the Wye, recalling thy prophetic words, bard, brother, friend from infancy. No need of motion or of strength or even the breathing air. I thought of nature's loveliest scenes, and with memory I was there.
Easy to see why both her brother William Wordsworth and Coleridge admired her so.
But in the 19th century, the voices of women became more assertive, more dangerous and surprising, taking on a wider range of subject matter. You all know this next poem, but I think not everybody knows that it was written by a woman, but I think there is a role for you in the choruses, so please join in.
Yeah, please do, because I'm not going to stand up here singing on my own. Battle Hymn of the Republic by Julia Ward Howe. It's very difficult to read because you want to sing it straight away, but I'm going to spare you that. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps. They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps. I can read his righteous sentence by the dim and flaring lamps. His day is marching on. 2, 3, 4.
Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. And so goes marching on.
Sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is shifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on. In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea, with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. His soul is marching on. 2, 3, 4.
Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. And his soul goes marching on.
Though there was... Hooray, you did very well. There was still more traditional love poetry.
How do I love thee, Elizabeth Barrett Browning? How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with the passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God chose, I shall but love thee better after death.
By the mid-century, there was also Emily Dickinson, who some of you, if you've got tickets for it, will be able to hear Juliet reading tomorrow morning. She only published 7 poems in her lifetime, and she scarcely ever left her house after the age of 40.
Wild nights... wild nights, were I with thee, wild nights should be our luxury. Futile the winds to a heart in port, done with the compass, done with the chart. Rowing in Eden, ah, the sea, might I but moor tonight in thee.
And then there's Christina Rossetti, who's known and loved for In the Bleak Midwinter.
Song. When I am dead, my dearest, sing no sad songs for me. Plant thou no roses at my head, nor shady cypress tree. Be the green grass above me, with showers and dewdrops wet. And if thou wilt, remember, and if thou wilt, forget. I shall not see the shadows, I shall not feel the rain, I shall not hear the nightingale sing on as if in pain. And dreaming through the twilight that doth not rise nor set, haply I may remember, and haply may forget.
The Call by Charlotte Mew. From our low seat beside the fire, where we have dozed and dreamed and watched the glow or raked the ashes, stopping so we scarcely saw the sun or rain above or looked much higher than this same quiet red or burnt out fire. Tonight we heard a call, a rattle on the window pane, a voice on the sharp air, and felt a breath stirring our hair, a flame within us. Something swift and tall swept in and out, and that was all. Was it a bright or dark angel? Who can know? It left no mark upon the snow, but suddenly it snapped the chain, unbarred, flung wide the door, which will not shut again, and so we cannot sit here any more. We must arise and go. The world is cold without and dark and hedged about with mystery and enmity and doubt. But we must go, though yet we do not know who called or what marks we shall leave upon the snow.
And so on into the 20th century, which to our shame was a century of war. Many of you will have come and heard last year Neil Astley, a reading from Neil Astley's wonderful anthology of First World War poetry, 100 Years War. And there's going to be another chance to see more, hear more of it tomorrow. But women also, that was mainly Wilfred Owen and Sigrid Sassoon and Rosenberg, and you know those great poets. But women too wrote really well about the war.
Winifred Letts, The Deserter. There was a man, don't mind his name, whom fear had dogged by night and day. He could not face the German guns, and so he turned and ran away. Just that, he turned and ran away. But who can judge him, you or I? God makes a man of flesh and blood who yearns to live and not to die. And this man, when he feared to die, was scared as any frightened child. His knees were shaking under him. His breath came fast. His eyes were wild. I've seen a hare with eyes as wild, with throbbing heart and sobbing breath. But, oh, it shames one's soul to see a man in abject fear of death. But fear had gripped him. So had death. His number had gone up that day. They might not heed his frightened eyes. They shot him when the dawn was grey. Blindfolded, when the dawn was grey, he stood there in a place apart. The shots rang out, and down he fell, an English bullet in his heart. An English bullet in his heart. But here's the irony of life. His mother thinks he fought and fell a hero, foremost in the strife. So she goes proudly to the strife, her best, her hero son she gave. Oh, well for her, she does not know. He lies in a deserter's grave.
This is a poem by Margaret Postgate Cole, who I didn't know of, and it says that she was an English author, social campaigner, and educationalist who worked for the peace movement during the First World War, helping her brother and others who were denied the right to refuse military service as conscientious objectors. The Falling Leaves. Today, as I rode by, I saw the brown leaves dripping from their tree in a still afternoon. When no wind whirled them whistling to the sky, but thickly, silently, they fell, like snowflakes wiping out the moon. And wandered slowly thence, for thinking of a gallant multitude which now, all withering, lay, slain by no wind of age or pestilence, but in their beauty strewed, like snowflakes falling on the Flemish clay.
This is by Edna St. Vincent Millay, Apostrophe to Man, on reflecting that the world is ready to go to war again. Detestable race, continue to expunge yourself, die out. Breed faster, crowd, encroach, sing hymns, build bombing airplanes. Make speeches, unveil statues, issue bonds, parade. Convert again into explosives the bewildered ammonia and the distracted cellulose. Convert again into putrescent matter drawing flies the hopeful bodies of the young. Exhort, pray. Pull long faces, be earnest, be all but overcome, be photographed. Confer, perfect your formulae, commercialize bacteria harmful to human tissue, put death on the market, breed, crowd, encroach, expand, expunge yourself, die out.
Women also responded to political issues. Here's Anna Makta Akhmatova, can I say it, feared by Joseph Stalin, who described her rather horrifically as half nun and half harlot.
In memory of a Leningrad boy, Anna Akhmatova. The lights are out. Trenches are dug in the garden. Petersburg orphans are my little children. One can't breathe underground. Pain drills the forehead. Through the bombing, a child's small voice is heard. Knock with your little fist. I'll open up. I always open my door to you. Now I've gone beyond the high mountain, the desert, the wind and the blazing heat, but I will never give you up. I did not hear you crying or asking me for bread. Bring me a twig from the maple tree, or just some blades of green grass as you did last spring. Bring me in your tiny cupped hands some clear, cool water from our Neva, and with my own hands I'll wipe clean the blood from your little golden head.
And then there's love again. But moving into the 20th century, with women gradually acquiring more freedoms, women poets began to write much more viscerally about sensuality and about sexual passion.
Carol Ann Duffy, Warming Her Pearls. I think I may have to take my jacket off for this. It's hot stuff. Next to my own skin, her pearls. My mistress bids me wear them, warm them, until evening when I'll brush her hair. At 6, I place them round her cool, white throat. All day I think of her, resting in the yellow room, contemplating silk or taffeta, which gown tonight. She fans herself, whilst I work willingly, my slow heat entering each pearl, slack on my neck, her rope. She's beautiful. I dream about her in my attic bed, picture her dancing with tall men, puzzled by my faint, persistent scent beneath her French perfume, her milky stones. I dust her shoulders with a rabbit's foot, watch the soft blush seep through her skin like an indolent sigh. In her looking glass, my red lips part as though I want to speak. Full moon. Her carriage brings her home. I see her every movement in my head, undressing, taking off her jewels, her slim hand reaching for the case, slipping naked into bed the way she always does. And I lie here awake, knowing the pearls are cooling, even now, in the room where my mistress sleeps. All night I feel their absence, and I burn.
Wedding by Alice Oswald. From time to time, our love is like a sail. And when the sail begins to alternate from tack to tack, it's like a swallowtail. And when the swallow flies, it's like a coat. And if the coat is yours, it has a tear, like a wide mouth. And when the mouth begins to draw the wind, it's like a trumpeter. And when the trumpet blows, it blows like millions. And this, my love, when millions come and go beyond the needs of us, is like a trick. And when the trick begins, it's like a toe tiptoeing on a rope, which is like luck. And when the luck begins, it's like a wedding, which is like love, which is like everything.
Ecstasy by Sharon Old. As we made love for the third day, cloudy and dark, as we did not stop but went into it, and did not hesitate and did not hold back, we rose through the air until we were up above the timber line. The lake lay icy and silver, the surface sheared, reflecting nothing. The black rocks lifted around it into the grainy, sepia air. The patches of snow, brilliant white. And even though we did not know where we were, we couldn't speak the language, we could hardly see, we did not stop, rising with the black rocks to the black hills, the black mountains rising from the hills. Resting on the crest of the mountains, one huge cloud with scalloped edges of blazing evening light. We did not turn back. We stayed with it. And even though we were far beyond what we knew, we rose into the grain of the cloud. Even though we were frightened, the air hollow, even though nothing grew there, even though it is a place from which no one has ever come back.
Anne Stevenson, The Marriage. They will fit, she thinks, but only if her backbone cuts exactly into his ribcage, and only if his knees dock exactly under her knees and all four agree on a common angle. All would be well if only they could face each other. Even as it is, there are compensations for having to meet nose to neck, chest to scapula, groin to rump when they sleep. They look, at least, as if they were going in the same direction.
Wendy Cope, Bloody Men. Bloody men are like bloody buses. You wait for about a year, and as soon as one approaches, you'll stop. Then two or three others appear. You look at them, flashing their indicators, offering you a ride. You're trying to read the destinations. You haven't much time to decide. If you make a mistake, there's no turning back. Jump off, and you'll stand there and gaze while the cars and the taxis and lorries go by, and the minutes, the hours, the days.
And then with love comes inevitably loss.
Telling my mother, Sharon Knowles. Outside her window, a cypress under the weight of the Pacific wind was bending luxuriously. To tell my mother that my husband is leaving me, I took her on a walk. Taking her fleshless hand like a parasite's claw, I bought her a donut and a hairnet. I fed her. On the gnarled magnolia in the fog, the blossoms and buds were like all the moons in one night, full gibbous crescent. I'd practice the speech, bringing her up towards the truth slowly, preparing her. And the moment I told her, she looked at me in shock and dismay. "But when will I ever see him again?" she cried out. I held hands with her and steadied us, joking. Above her spruce through the coastal mist, for a moment a tall, small, dry, sandy, glistering star. Then I felt my whole body for a second that I had not loved enough. I could almost see my husband's long shape writhing up. I did not know him. I did not work not to lose him. And I lost him. And I've told my mother. And it's clear from her harrowed, sorrowing cheeks and childhood mountain lake eyes that she loves me. So the men are gone, and I'm back with Mom. I always feared this would happen. I thought it would be pure horror, but it's just home. Mom's home, house and garden, earth, olive, willow, beech and orchid, and the paperweight dusted with opal, inside it the arms of a nebula raking its heavens with a soft screaming.
Wonderful, Sharon Knowles. Some of you have been lucky enough to hear her read her own poetry here at Ledbury a couple of years ago. But our own Lizzie Lockhead, who is the poet laureate in Scotland, is also wonderful, and she's written beautifully about... She had a great husband called Tom Logan, a fine architect, who died. She loved very much, and she wrote this poem about him.
Persimmons. You must have loved those three globes of gorgeous orange, dense and glowing in our winter kitchen. Enough to put coloured pencil and biro to the reddest page in your rainbow sketchbook and make this drawing of three persimmons in that Chinese bowl. The supermarket flagged them up as this season's Sharon fruit, but we prefer persimmon. For didn't it seem the rose of any other name would neither taste or sound as sweet, would be a fruit of quite another colour? Such strange fruit we bit and ate, enjoyed. Before we did, you drew them. Oh, you'd say, so what? Drawing to you is as everyday as apples. But I know they'd have come and gone like Christmas if you'd not put them down and made them worth more than the paper they're inscribed on. See those deft strokes of aquamarine and white that make our tabletop lie flat, the fruits plump out real and round and perfectly persimmon-coloured upon their lilac shadows in the bowl's deep. Still life. Still life, sweetheart, in what's already eaten and done with. Now, looking, I can taste again.
She loved him very much. And Leland Bardwell, not so much in her poem about husbands.
Husbands, Leland Bardwell. My first husband hated intelligent women. He thought they were like avocado pears. Expensive, tasteless. He said if I was let loose, I might go to Mexico, although his horizons were leather skirts. My second husband hated Mexicans and me. He said we'd ended the transfer. He liked Antonioni women with short hair and big bums and wanted to be one. I'd like new now with no hatred and superb teeth. Both my husbands had grey smiles and were transvestites. I thought that's stupid. So what if my breasts are like two fried eggs? They haven't any. I once screwed in Euston Station and saw Mercury running. If I could have bottled it, I'd have made a fortune.
Fleur Adcock, Against Coupling. I write in praise of the solitary act, of not feeling a trespassing tongue forced into one's mouth, one's breath smothered, nipples crushed against the ribcage, and that metallic tingling in the chin set off by a certain odd nerve. Unpleasure. Just to avoid those eyes would help. Such eyes as a young girl draws life from, listening to the vegetal rustle within her as his gaze stirs polypal fronds in the obscure seabed of her body and her own eyes blur. There is much to be said for abandoning this no longer novel exercise. For now, participating in a total experience. When one feels like the lady in Leeds who had seen The Sound of Music 86 times. Or more, perhaps, like the school drama mistress producing A Midsummer Night's Dream for the seventh year running with yet another class from 5B. Pyramus and Thisbe are dead, but the hole in the wall can still be troublesome. I advise you, then, to embrace it without encumbrance. No need to set the scene, dress up or undress, make speeches. 5 minutes of solitude are enough. In the bath, or to fill that gap between the Sunday papers and lunch.
Rubbish at Adultery by Sophie Hannah. Must I give up another night to hear you whinge and whine about how terribly grim you feel and what a dreadful swine you are? You say you'll never leave your wife and children. Fine. When have I ever asked you to? I'd settle for a kiss. Couldn't you, for an hour or so, just leave them out of this? A rare 10 minutes off from guilty diatribes. What bliss. Yes, I'm aware you're sensitive. A tortured, wounded soul. I'm after passion, thrills and fun. You say fun takes its toll. So what are we doing here? I fear we've lost our common goal. You're rubbish at adultery. I think you ought to quit. Trouble is, at fidelity, you're also slightly shit. Choose one and do it properly, you stupid, stupid git.
Women poets have always been rather good at facing aging with clear eyes. Stevie Smith went so far as to write, "I love death. I think it's the most exciting thing." Why do people grumble about old age so much?
Getting older, Elaine Feinstein. The first surprise, I like it. Whatever happens now, some things that used to terrify have not. I didn't die young, for instance, or lose my only love. My three children never had to run away from anyone. Don't tell me this gratitude is complacent. We all approach the edge of the same blackness, which for me is silent. Knowing as much sharpens my delight in January freesia, hot coffee, winter sunlight. So we say, as we lie close on some gentle occasion, every day won from such darkness is a celebration.
Stevie Smith, not waving but drowning. Nobody heard him, the dead man, but still he lay moaning. I was much further out than you thought, and not waving but drowning. Poor chap. He always loved larking, and now he's dead. It must have been too cold for him. His heart gave way, they said. Oh, no, no, no. It was too cold, always. Still the dead one lay moaning. I was much too far out all my life, and not waving, but drowning.
Body by Sasha Mawson. What was so quiet a companion, my dumb friend, now cries out, groans, swells up with noxious fluid, clamoring for attention. Did I neglect you? Take you for granted, the ease with which you walked and breathed, ran for a bus? We that were one are two. I bow before you.
Family is very much a part of most women's experience and lives, but women poets are not always sentimental about it and have written some surprising poems on the theme.
Papa Love Baby, Stevie Smith. My mother was a romantic girl, so she had to marry a man with his hair in curl, who subsequently became my unrespected papa. But that was a long time ago now. What folly it is that daughters are always supposed to be in love with papa. It wasn't the case with me. I couldn't take to him at all, but he took to me. What a sad fate to befall a child of three. I sat upright in my baby carriage and wished Mama hadn't made such a foolish marriage. I tried to hide it, but it showed in my eyes, unfortunately, and a fortnight later, Papa ran away to sea. He used to come home on leave. It was always the same. I couldn't grieve, but I think I was somewhat to blame.
Slow Reader by Vicky Fever. He can make sculptures and fabulous machines, invent games, tell jokes, give solemn adult advice. but he is slow to read. When I take him on my knee with his ladybird book, he gazes into the air, sighing and shaking his head like an old man who knows the mountains are impassable. He toys with words, letting them go cold as grisly meat, until I relent and let him wriggle free, a fish returning to its element, or a white-eyed colt shying from the bit who sees that if he takes it in his mouth, he'll never run quite free again.
For a 5-year-old, Fleur Adcock. A snail is climbing up the windowsill into your room after a night of rain. You call me in to see, and I explain that it would be unkind to leave it there. It might crawl to the floor. We must take care that no one squashes it. You understand, and carry it outside with careful hand to eat a daffodil. I see then that a kind of faith prevails. Your gentleness is molded still by words from me, who have trapped mice and shot wild birds. From me, who drowned your kittens, who betrayed your closest friends and relatives, who purveyed the harshest kind of truth to many another. But that's how things are. I am your mother, and we are kind to snails.
Grace Paley, One Day. One day, lying on my stomach in the afternoon, trying to sleep, I suffered penis envy. Much to my surprise, and with no belief in Freud for years, in fact, extreme antipathy. What could I do but turn around and close my eyes and dream of summer? In those days, I was a boy. I whistled at the gate for Tom. Then I woke up. Then I slept and dreamed another dream. In my drowned father's empty pocket, there were $9 and the salty sea. He said, I know you, my darling girl. You're the one that's me.
Then there's a tricky question of power. 20th century women poets have been quite articulate about power, and particularly about taking back their own power. And no one knew that better than Maya Angelou, and indeed other black poets, who understood it all too well.
This is not the whole poem, you'll be relieved to hear. It's just a part of her wonderful poem, Phenomenal Woman. Pretty women wonder where my secret lies. I'm not cute or built to suit a fashion model's size. But when I start to tell them, they think I'm telling lies. I say, it's in the reach of my arms, the span of my hips, the stride of my step, the curl of my lips. I'm a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman, that's me. I walk into a room just as cool as you please, and to a man the fellows stand or fall down on their knees. Then they swarm around me, a hive of honeybees. I say, it's the fire in my eyes and the flash of my teeth, the swing in my waist and the joy in my feet. I'm a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman. That's me.
Because she has come, Grace Nichols. Because she has come with geometrical designs upon her breasts. Because she has borne 5 children and her belly is crisscrossed with little tones of fire. Because she has braided her hair in the cornrow, twisting it upwards to show her high inner status. Because she has tucked a bright wrap about her Nubian brownies. Because she has stained her toes with the juice of the henna to attract any number of arrant males. Because she has the good sense to wear a scarab to protect her heart. Because she has a pearl in the middle of her lower delta. Give her honor. Give her honor, you fools. Give her honor.
Mm-hmm. Is it me next?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, so you probably know this one. It's Sylvia Plath, Daddy. You do not do anymore, black shoe, in which I have lived like a foot for 30 years, poor and white, barely daring to breathe or a chew. Daddy, I have had to kill you. You died before I had time. Marble heavy, a bag full of God, ghastly statue with one grey toe, big as a Frisco seal, and a head in the freakish Atlantic, where it pours bean green over blue in the waters off beautiful Norset. I used to pray to recover you. Ach, du. In the German tongue, in the Polish town, scraped flat by the roller of wars, wars, wars. But the name of the town is common. My Polack friend says there are a dozen or two, so I never could tell where you put your foot, your root. I never could talk to you. The tongue stuck in my jaw. It stuck in a barbed wire snare. Ich, ich, ich. Ich, I hardly could speak. I thought every German was you, and the language obscene, an engine, chuffing me off like a Jew to Dachau, Auschwitz, Belsen. I began to talk like a Jew. I think I may well be a Jew. The snows of the Tyrol, the clear beer of Vienna, are not very pure or true. With my gypsy ancestress and my weird luck and my tarok pack and my tarok pack, I may be a bit of a Jew. I have always been scared of you, with your Luftwaffe, your gobbledygoo, and your neat moustache, and your Aryan eye, bright blue. Panzer man, oh you! Not God, but a swastika, so black no sky could squeak through. Every woman adores a fascist, the boot in the face, the brute, brute heart of a brute like you. You stand at the blackboard, Daddy, in the picture I have of you, a cleft in your chin instead of your foot. But no less a devil for that, no, not any less the black man who bit my pretty red heart in two. I was 10 when they buried you. At 20, I tried to die and get back, back, back to you. I thought even the bones would do. But they pulled me out of the sack, and they stuck me together with glue. And then I knew what to do. I made a model of you, a man in black with a Mein Kampf look, and a love of the rack and the screw. And I said, I do, I do. So, Daddy, I'm finally through. The black telephone's off at the root. The voices just can't worm through. If I've killed one man, I've killed two. The vampire who said he was you and drank my blood for a year. 7 years, if you want to know. Daddy, you can lie back now. There's a stake in your fat black heart, and the villagers never liked you. They are dancing and stamping on you. They always knew it was you. Daddy, Daddy, you bastard, I'm through.
And here are some more women poets on love and sex, because, of course, they're subjects that are impossible to avoid.
This is by Margaret Atwood. Habitation. Marriage is not a house or even a tent. It is before that, and colder. The edge of the forest, the edge of the desert, the unpainted stairs at the back where we squat outside eating popcorn. The edge of the receding glacier, where painfully and with wonder at having survived even thus far, we are learning to make fire.
Denise Levertov, The Ache of Marriage. The ache of marriage. Thigh and tongue, beloved, are heavy with it. It throbs in the teeth. We look for communion and are turned away, beloved, each and each. It is Leviathan, and we in its belly looking for joy, some joy not to be known outside it. Two by two in the arc of the ache of it.
Spunk Talking by Anne Rouse. When men are belligerent or crude, it's spunk talking. It's come up for a verbal interlude. In your face, Jack, get shagged, get screwed, get your tits out. Get him, lads, bugger that. Hands off, just you try it. You're Nick, left hook, nice one, Eric. Hammer hard, shaft him, stitch that. Do you want to get laid or not? Red card. Spunk speaks in gutturals with verbs, no parentheses. Spunk's a young con, crazy to break from Alcatraz. Sonny, you'll go feet first, so Spunk has to sing hoarsely the song of the vulgar boatman. I am an anarchist, the trog's wild thing. Cynthia Payne said, after her researches, not to be debunked, that men are appreciably nicer when despunked. Before time began, the void revolved as smooth and bored as an egg, when a tiny ragged crack appeared, and the world exploded like an umpire's shout as the primal spunk of the cosmos bellowed, "Out!"
But sadly, in this century, there is always more war.
Helen Dunmore, in the desert, knowing nothing. Here I am in the desert, knowing nothing. Here I am, knowing nothing, in the desert of knowing nothing. Here I am in this wide desert, long after midnight. Here I am, knowing nothing, hearing the noise of the rain and the melt of fat in the pan. Here is our man on the phone knowing something, and here's our man fresh from the briefing, in combat jeans and a clip microphone testing for sound, catching the desert rain, knowing something. Here's the general who's good with his men, storming the camera, knowing something. In the pit of his Americanness, here's the general taut in his battle dress and knowing something. Here's the boy washing his kit in a tarpaulin on a front line he knows from his GCSE coursework on Wilfred Owen, and knowing something. Here is the plane banking, the go, go, go of adrenaline, the child melting. And here's the grass that grows overnight from the desert rain, feeling for him and knowing everything. And here I am, knowing nothing. In the desert of knowing nothing, dry from not speaking.
The end and the beginning. Wislawa Szymborska. After every war, someone's got to tidy up. Things won't pick themselves up after all. Someone's got to shove the rubble to the roadside so the carts loaded with corpses can get by. Someone's got to trudge through sludge and ashes, through the sofa springs, the shards of glass, the bloody rags. Someone's got to lug the post to prop the wall. Someone's got to glaze the windows, set the door in its frame. No sound bites, no photo opportunities. It takes years. All the cameras have gone to other wars. The bridges need to be rebuilt. The railroad stations too. Shirt sleeves will be rolled to shreds. Someone, broom in hand, still remembers how it was. Someone else listens, nodding his unshattered head. But others are bound to be bustling nearby who'll find all that a little boring. From time to time, someone still must dig up a rusted argument from underneath a bush and haul it off to the dump. Those who knew what this was all about must make way for those who know little and less than that, and at last nothing less than nothing. Someone's got to lie there in the grass that covers up the causes and effects with a cornstalk in his teeth, gawking at the clouds.
And in our generation, the horrors of terrorism. Eliza Griswold, not well known in England, but an American poet and journalist who's reported from Iraq and Afghanistan and other trouble spots.
homeland, Eliza Griswold. He detonates at 5 a.m. The sound is unmistakable. First flesh, then second thoughts. The windows rattle as we two women do in aftershock. Bolt upright from the floor, you muttered, Bismillah. I shudder, shit, and grab my swelling belly. Usually, the head survives intact, a hand in a tree. By 6 a.m. we quit Jalalabad. I apologize and disregard your cold, coal eyes when I reach for the back seat's only belt.
And there are other more personal losses.
Story of a Hotel Room by Rosemary Tonks. Thinking we were safe, insanity, we went in to make love. All the same, idiots to trust the little hotel bedroom. Then, in the gloom, and who does not know that pair of shutters with the awkward hook on them, all screeching whispers? Very well, then, in the gloom, we set about acquiring one another, urgently. But on a temporary basis, only as guests, just guests of one another's senses. But idiots, to feel so safe, you hold back nothing, because the bed of cold electric linen happens to be illicit. To make love as well as that is ruinous. Londoner, Parisian, someone should have warned us that without permanent intentions, you have absolutely no protection. If the act is clean, authentic, sumptuous, the concurring deep love of the heart follows the naked work, profoundly moved by it.
For my lover, returning to his wife. She's always been there, my darling. She is, in fact, exquisite. Fireworks in the dull middle of February, and as real as a cast iron pot. Let's face it, I have been momentary, a luxury, a bright red sloop in the harbour, my hair rising like smoke from the car window, little neck clams out of season. She is more than that. She is your have to have, has grown you your practical, your tropical growth. This is not an experiment. She is all harmony. She sees to oars and oarlocks for the dinghy. I give you back your heart. I give you permission. She is so naked and singular. She is the sum of yourself and your dream. Climb her like a monument, step after step. She is solid. As for me, I am a watercolor. I wash off.
One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seemed filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster. Places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I missed them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love. I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, a disaster.
Backwards by Warson Shire. The poem can start with him walking backwards into a room. He takes off his jacket and sits down for the rest of his life. That's how we bring Dad back. I can make the blood run back up my nose, ants rushing into a hole. We grow into smaller bodies, my breasts disappear, your cheeks soften, teeth sink back into gums. I can make us loved, just say the word. Give them stumps for hands if ever they once touched us without consent. I can write the poem and make it disappear. Stepdad spits liquor back into glass. Mum's body rolls back up the stairs. The bone pops back into place. Maybe she keeps the baby. Maybe we're okay, kid. I'll rewrite this whole life, and this time there'll be so much love, you won't be able to see beyond it. You won't be able to see beyond it. I'll rewrite this whole life, and this time there'll be so much love. Maybe we're okay, kid. Maybe she keeps the baby. Mum's body rolls back up the stairs. The bone pops back into place. Stepdad spits liquor back into glass. I can write the poem and make it disappear. Give them stumps for hands if even once they touched us without consent. I can make us love. Just say the word. Your cheeks soften, teeth sink back into gums. We grow into smaller bodies, my breasts disappear. I can make the blood run back up my nose, ants rushing into a hole. That's how we bring Dad back. He takes off his jacket and sits down for the rest of his life. The poem can start with him walking backwards into a room.
This is a chunk, because you know her stuff is very, very long, so it's a chunk of a piece by Kate Tempest, amazing performance poet, I'm sure you know her. The gods are all here, because the gods are in us. The gods are in the betting shops. The gods are in the caf. The gods are smoking fags out the back. The gods are in the office blocks. The gods are at their desks. The gods are sick of always giving more and getting less. The gods are at the rave, two pills deep into dancing. The gods are in the alleyway, laughing. The gods are at the doctors, they need a little something for the stress. The gods are in the toilets, having unprotected sex. The gods are in the supermarket, the gods are walking home. The gods can't stop checking Facebook on their phones. The gods are in a traffic jam, the gods are on the train. The gods are watching adverts, the gods are not to blame. They are working for the council, now they're on the dole. Now they're getting drunk, pissing wages down a hole. The gods are in their gardens, with their decking and their plants. The gods are in the classrooms, the poor things don't stand a chance. Trying to tell the truth, but the truth is hard to say. The gods are born, they live a while, and then they pass away. They lose themselves in crowds, their guts are full of rot. They hope there's something more to life, but can't imagine what. These gods have got no oracles to translate their requests. These gods have got a headache and a payment plan and stress about when next they'll see their kids. They're not fighting over favourites, they're just getting on with it. We are the brand new ancients. So choose one. Choose any of these gods watching telly on their own, feeling bored but not knowing what the more is to want it. Choose one, look again, and you will see the gods rise in the most human and unassuming of eyes.
And then there are reflections and hopes and endings.
Sometimes, by Sheena Pugh. Sometimes things don't go, after all, from bad to worse. Some years muscadel faces down frost, green thrives, the crops don't fail. Sometimes a man aims high and all goes well. A people sometimes will step back from war, elect an honest man, decide they care enough that they can't leave some stranger poor. Some men become what they were born for. Sometimes our best efforts do not go amiss. Sometimes we do as we meant to. The sun will sometimes melt a field of sorrow that seemed hard frozen. May it happen to you.
Song by Adrian Rich. You're wondering if I'm lonely. Okay then, yes, I'm lonely. As a plane rides lonely and level on its radio beam, aiming across the Rockies for a blue-strung isles of an airfield on the ocean. You want to ask, am I lonely? Well, of course.
lonely as a woman driving across country day after day, leaving behind mile after mile little towns she might have stopped and lived and died in. Lonely. If I'm lonely, it must be the loneliness of waking first, of breathing dawn's first cold breath on the city, of being the one awake in a house wrapped in sleep. If I'm lonely, it's with the rowboat ice fast on the shore in the last red light of the year that knows what it is, that knows it's neither ice nor mud nor winter light, but wood with a gift for burning.
Resume, Dorothy Parker. Razors pain you, rivers are damp, acid stains you, and drugs cause cramp. Guns aren't lawful, nooses give, gas smells awful. You might as well live.
Swing by Imtiaz Darker. There is nothing more than a swing door between living and dying. You have mastered the art, half in, half out, time's magician of spinning something out of nothing. You conjure 7 years out of 7 days, 7 moons out of half a song. I've got the hang of this, you say, this dying lark, and here you are living as hard as you humanly can all the way to dying. You set the door swinging so fast, I don't know if I am coming or going, spun out to thin air or reeled back to your mouth for the kiss that denies we are dying, dying on the way to living or living on the way to dying, and we are laughing so hard we can't tell anymore. Mary Jan, Cariad, we can't tell if we are laughing or crying.
Cora Kaplan, in the 70s, edited a wonderful collection of poetry, which we've used quite a lot for this anthology, called The Salt and Bitter and Good. And she said, women's poetry vindicates women's experience, not so much by praising it, as by questioning and exploring it. So we hope you agree that, having heard these dangerous women, that women's poetry is alive and well, and seems in very good health.
Not least because of Carol Ann Duffy, the first woman to be poet laureate, and we are very proud to say the leading patron of the Ledbury Poetry Festival. And so we end with her.
Okay.
Yep.
So we're all going to do this one. And it's called, I'm sure you know, it's from this wonderful collection called The World's Wife, in which she imagines, in each poem, she takes a very famous man and imagines what it's like to be his wife. And this one we're all three going to do is called Mrs. Midas. It was late September. I just poured a glass of wine, begun to unwind while the vegetables cooked. The kitchen filled with the smell of itself, relaxed, its steamy breath gently blanching the windows. So I opened one, then with my fingers wiped the other's glass like a brow. He was standing under the pear tree, snapping a twig.
Now the garden was long and the visibility poor, the way the dark of the ground seems to drink the light of the sky. But that twig in his hand was gold. And then he plucked a pear from a branch. We grew fondant, Tom. And it sat in the palm of, like a light bulb, on. I thought to myself, is he putting fairy lights in the tree?
He came into the house. The doorknobs gleamed.
He drew the blinds. You know the mind. I thought of the field of the cloth of gold and of Miss Macready. He sat in that chair like a king on a burnished throne. The look on his face was strange, wild, vain. I said, what in the name of God is going on? He started to laugh.
I served up the meal. For starters, corn on the cob. Within seconds, he was spitting out the teeth of the rich. He toyed with his spoon, then mine, then with the knives, the forks. He asked where was the wine. I poured with shaking hand a fragrant bone-dry white from Italy, then watched as he picked up the glass. Goblet. Golden chalice. Drank.
It was then that I started to scream. He sank to his knees, and after we both calmed down, I finished the wine on my own. Hearing him out, I made him sit on the other side of the room and keep his hands to himself. I locked the cat in the cellar. I moved the phone. The toilet I didn't mind. I couldn't believe my ears.
How it had a wish. Look, we all have wishes granted. But who has wishes granted? Him. Do you know about gold? It feeds no one. Aurum, soft, untarnishable, slakes no thirst. He tried to light a cigarette. I gazed, entranced, as the blue flame played on its luteous stem. At least, I said, you'll be able to give up smoking for good.
Separate beds. In fact, I put a chair against my door. Near petrified, he was below, turning the spare room into the tomb of Tutankhamun. You see, we were passionate then, in those halcyon days, unwrapping each other rapidly like presents, fast food. But now I feared his honeyed embrace, the kiss that would turn my lips into a work of art.
And who, when it comes to the crunch, can live with a heart of gold? That night, I dreamt I bore his child, its perfect all limbs, its little tongue like a precious latch, its amber eyes holding their pupils like flies. My dream milk burned in my breast. I woke to the streaming sun.
So we had to move out. We'd a caravan in the wilds, in a glade of its own. I drove him up under cover of dark. He sat in the back. And then I came home. The woman who married the fool who wished for gold. At first, I visited, odd times, parking the car a good way off, then walking.
You knew when you were getting close, golden trout on the grass. One day, a hare hung from a larch, a beautiful lemon mistake. And then his footprints glistening near to the river's path. He was thin, delirious, hearing, he said, the music of Pan from the woods. Listen. That was the last straw.
What gets me now is not the idiocy or greed, but lack of thought for me. Pure selfishness. I sold the contents of the house and came down here. I think of him in certain lights, dawn, late afternoon, and once a bowl of apples stopped me dead. I miss most, even now, his hands, his warm hands on my skin, his touch.
Wonderful. Wonderful.